Hi guys, it's Tony. I'm afraid I screwed up our plans for the podcast tonight. I had to go get sick. I think I got an ear infection. I don't know. I'm messed up. Anyway, I'm not going to subject William to whatever it is. So, we are going to give you another one of those interdimensional episodes that you guys love so much. So, without further ado, I introduce mystery episode, I don't remember, what is it, five? Something like that, I don't know. Mystery episode, this one. There you go.
In a world completely overrun by inane media, there are podcasts that rise above the rest. This is not one of those. Two middle-aged white guys from Middle America talk about random shit for about an hour or so. This is the Magical Talking Hat.
Okay. We are live-ish.
Okay.
Nice goatee.
Thank you. Yours also.
Yes. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast. The only podcast in this entire universe, because this is a universe without podcasts. Except ours.
Except this one.
Yes. We're special. Because this is not a normal episode.
No.
This is a Tony overdosed on heroin and is passed out in his yard and can't do the podcast kind of episode. This is a William forgot how to dress himself and so can't come over to do the podcast episode. Ooh. So we don't even know what episode number it is. It's just an episode.
Yep, we have no idea.
How has your unspecified amount of time been, William?
It has been insert status of unspecified time here.
Ah. Mine has been similar, but more adjective.
Excellent.
Oh, wait, we need a Mad Lib episode. That came up recently. Somebody was trying to create Mad Libs. And they were having trouble with it, and they explained the process they were using to me, and I'm like, that's just weird. I said, here's what you do. You write a story, a little tiny story, mm-hmm. and then you remove words,
yeah.
and instead put in what type of language.
Yeah.
They were trying to do the sort of the other way.
Where just make blanks and then put stuff in between it?
Kind of, yeah. Here we'll have some nouns and some. And I was like, no, just write something and then take the
and
bits out.
Take some stuff out, yes, that's right.
But, yeah. All right, so we don't know what kind of year it is, so don't ask us.
Nope. And we can't tell you how their week went, and nor do we particularly care.
No.
Because
I work hard to avoid. I don't even listen to this podcast. Do you listen to this podcast?
Nope.
For all I know, the format is very different on episodes.
Although, I did check out the blog for the last time we did this, and it was interesting to see what some people said about our particular podcast as opposed to the other guys.
What's a blog?
Oh, sorry. I forgot. Over there, they have these Okay, so imagine you're in a classroom with a blackboard in front.
I'm imagining.
Okay, and
am I wearing pants?
Well, I don't know if that matters.
But I've had that dream a lot. It freaks me out.
Okay, you're not wearing pants.
All right, good.
Okay, so one person goes up to the blackboard and writes something on it and sits down. And then somebody else, whoever feels like it, goes up and they write something on the blackboard too that's like in a response to what that person said.
Have they all had their tongues ripped out or something? Or?
Yes.
Well, I guess that's why they do that, then.
Yeah.
All right.
This is kind of like that.
Sounds horrific.
Well, it is a little bit. And so anyhow, when the podcast is posted, a person might say something about the podcast, and then someone else will say something about the podcast, and then someone else will say something about it, like on the blackboard.
So in the other universe, nobody has tongues?
Hmm. I didn't really think about that. I mean, I don't know them. I just know they're writing on this kind of virtual blackboard. That's all I know. Maybe they don't.
I'm kind of sad.
But no, they must, because the other guys do. Maybe they're the only ones in that universe that do.
That would explain
just like
very little, but still.
Just like we're the only ones who have a podcast.
Yeah.
That's kind of they're the only ones that can speak, and we're the only ones with a podcast.
It's a little sad, actually, because the way I thought you were going to explain what blogs were, was going to prompt me to say, my, how narcissistic. But then you didn't. So I had that joke waiting.
Why did you think I was going to?
I don't know why I thought that you might say something that would prompt me to think blogs narcissistic.
I'm all about process. Although, now that you mention it, just coincidentally, usually these blogs are kind of owned by one person. So it's not like in the classroom where the chalkboard is sort of community property.
It's more like someone's journal done live.
And other people are making comments about it. It is more like that. So yes, you're right. It is kind of narcissistic. But how did you know that?
I imagine.
Hmm. Maybe it's those psychic powers that you have.
It is.
Because there's psychic powers in this universe.
What an odd thing to say.
Well, I happen to know there aren't in that universe.
Because from reading this blog?
Well, not that one. Okay, I read some other blog. I did some other things.
Oh.
I'm not proud of it.
You know a really fun thing you can do during these mystery episodes where we don't know what time of year it is or anything?
What's that?
I can say, I looked at XKCD the other day, and it was really weird. Because I was going to say that, and then I was like, no, wait, that makes it time sensitive. And I'm like, wait, no, it doesn't. That pretty much means it's a time. Like,
yeah, and in every universe, it's a weird comic.
Oh, yeah, XKCD makes no sense throughout the multiverse, but we all still like it. All right, so, Hat. Da, 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 da.
You know, if it weren't for the power of this hat, we wouldn't have these multi-dimensional, multi-universal powers.
No, the power of hat compels us. If you, in whatever dimension you are, would like to write the hat, do it. At themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Void where prohibited.
Dear the Magical Talking Hat...
Just kidding, the hat does not talk.
This is from Kia B.
Kia B! Also, in this world, in this universe, she's still concerned that we won't know which Kia it is. So, Kia is a very common name over here.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody, ever since that car company saved the lives of all those people,
people
have named their kid after it.
Regarding movie adaptation, should one read the book or see the movie first? This seems very familiar.
Here's the deal.
This question.
Not only do I feel like we have done this question before, I feel like Kia has asked us this question before.
You think so?
The hat might be doubling up on itself.
Read the book or see the movie first.
Well, here is a lesson I have recently learned. Not that recently, but within the last few years.
Okay.
Reading the book right before you see the movie, whether it be reading the book because you haven't yet right before you see the movie, or rereading the book because the movie's coming out, both of those things, terrible idea.
Hmm.
They will cause you to not enjoy the movie. Almost guaranteed. Even if the movie's fairly decent, fairly faithful, it will be so fresh in your mind that even the slightest idiosyncrasies and differences will stick out, and it's a terrible thing. And I used to do this constantly and hated it.
Well, I'll be honest. I can't think of any reason unless you've... I mean, okay. Obviously, you're going to read some books that haven't been made into movies, and you don't know that they're going to be made into movies, and then later they're made into a movie, so you couldn't help it. But if you can help it, I can't think of any reason why you'd read the book first. Because most of the time... Well, here's the thing. I haven't ever heard of one instance where someone would say, gosh, I should have read the book first.
Well, here
I've never heard of people who said that.
I have what I think is a strong argument, one for each side on this.
Okay.
Because I have one that I held, and then somebody argued with me, and I was like, your argument
because
is
to me,
also good.
To me, the movie is going to be either worse or as good. And even if you think the movie's better, you won't think the book is so much worse that it'll bother you.
It's and also, you're never going to think the movie's better, let's
well,
be honest. That
but,
has yet to happen in the history
but
of
But those
mankind.
Are the things that will happen. The movie will either be worse, as good, or even if you think it's better, the book is not going to be so much worse that it's going to bother you that you read the book after you watched the movie. But almost every time, if the movie isn't as good as the book, you'll wish you saw the movie first so that you could at least enjoy it a little bit.
Yes, and that is what my argument, my fairly newfound argument, now that I've learned my lesson about this, is watch the movie. And typically, movie's worse than book. So you watch the movie, you're like, that's okay. And then you read the book, and you kind of enjoy the movie, because you're like, that's okay, it's nice. And then you read the book, and you're like, wow, this book is even more awesome. And so you enjoy the book. And so you enjoyed both. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you read the book, and you're like, this book is awesome, and then you see the movie, and you're like, it's not as good, then you don't enjoy the movie. Mm-hmm. However, there is a compelling reason to do it the other way around. That did not ever occur to me before.
Well, I suppose, before you say it, I suppose you're going to enjoy the book a completely different way if you don't know what's going to happen in it. I mean, there's that.
There is that, but I mean, that's true for the movie, too. I mean, the movie gets spoiled for you if you read the book
first.
Well,
but some people would rather a movie get spoiled than a book get spoiled.
Possibly. So that's not where I'm going with
this. Okay.
Let me carry you through this.
All right.
You've read some Harry Potter?
No.
Okay.
Not interested.
All right.
And watching the films didn't make me more interested.
But you did see the films.
Yes.
Okay.
No, wait. Okay. I've heard some Harry Potter on tape because I've been traveling with kids who are listening to it. And so I guess I know where
I'm
But you
have seen some Harry Potter movies.
I've seen all the Harry Potter movies, yes.
Okay. If you tomorrow were to go and pick up Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and start reading it, what would Harry Potter look like?
I don't know. In the movie, I guess.
He'd look like Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, but see, that's
and
not a very good example.
Everybody would look exactly like
I know, but
like
that's not a good example
movies.
because the Harry Potter book covers has a little kid on it that looks like... I mean, Radcliffe looks like the picture that people drew.
Somewhat,
that's not a very good example.
But,
you got to use
an
example. You
see my argument.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, there's the huge one with the Hunger Games.
Yeah, that's a better one.
And everybody was totally pissed off about black people because... People are racist assholes. But, I mean, that's the thing. And this is what the person said to me. They said, I want to read the book and have the images in my head of what people look like that are my images.
Well, okay,
if I see the movie first, I'm always, forever and ever, going to see them the way they were in the movies.
That's just a slight variation on the I'd rather have a movie spoiled than a book spoiled. I mean...
I don't think it is at all. I think it's an entirely different.
No, it's it's all about the experience of reading the book and how the world is constructed in your mind. Yes, how the people look, how the places look, how the plot unfolds. And you're right. If you watch the movie first, all of that stuff is done for you. How the plot unfolds, what the people look like, what the places look like, and you want to be able to do that for yourself. All that stuff is spoiled in a way. If you see the movie first. And so, I mean, yeah, if a person wants, if they enjoy the experience of reading a book and building all that stuff in their head, character, plot, place, well, yeah, okay, read the book first. But if you don't really care, you know, if both things exist, the book and the movie, and you don't really care about that.
But why would you not care about that? I think anybody who reads fiction...
Well, but you're talking to the wrong person because I don't really care about reading fiction, so...
You're weird. You're William.
Well, then the answer to Kia's question is, if you are a big fan of fiction, then you ought to read the book first.
Well, the real answer probably is, if you're a big fan of fiction, you ought to never see the movie.
Well, that's probably true. But if reading fiction and watching fiction in film are equally whatever, I would think you would watch the film first. But if you're more a book person than a film person, because here's the thing, I enjoy fiction as much as the next person. I just enjoy it more in a film than I do in a book.
Yeah. I think I'm more of a book person than a film person, but I'm still sticking with mine. See the movie first, because I feel like I can enjoy them both that way, and the potential to not enjoy the movie is stronger if I do the book first.
But that must mean you don't put much of a premium on your own picture of the characters or your own picture of the setting or anything like that.
Well, I don't know, because this is a relatively new opinion of mine. And so I haven't really had a chance to test it out. And the argument I put forth for reading the book first is even newer. And so I really haven't had a chance to put it to
test. Here's another thing, too, is some people, when they read the book after watching the film, do not really see it the way the film portrayed it. I don't, for example, necessarily.
I'm wondering if I don't. I don't know yet.
I mean,
lately, it hasn't come up a lot in general.
Well, for one thing, Harry
Potter is the only thing, really.
Though. I might feel like the author describes the character of the place in a very different way than was portrayed in the film. In which case, I'll go with whatever the author says.
If it's a drastic change in the adaptation, that can be a big thing.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, I've read a lot of fiction where maybe I saw a film or a couple films, and I read the author, and I feel like it's different enough, the way the author wrote it, that what I'm picturing is different than what the... In fact, I think to myself, gosh, if I was making this film, this is how I'd make it. This is how it looked. This is who I would cast. And so I see completely different things.
Mm. And then we have the other side, which is like this for me now. I have not read the Hunger Games book. I don't plan to.
Mm-hmm.
I plan to see all the movies. I saw the first one. I plan to see the others. Don't plan to read the books. I think I'm getting enough out of the movies. And I don't care. I care enough to see a 2.5-hour film. I don't care enough to read a book.
Yeah, reading fiction, I've done a fair share of it, but it's not something that I really enjoy like a lot of people do. And it's not just about the time invested and the work in it. It's... When I read, I read very slowly, and I put a lot of more work into it than I probably need to just read it. And I practically make the film in my head. I mean, every time I read something, I'm thinking about how to turn it into a film. So I might as well just watch the film. That's really what it comes down to. But That's how it works for me. I guess it's different for everybody as far as reading the book or watching the movie first.
Do you feel like that is a similar response that Other Dimension William would have?
Yes. Okay. That's one thing we have in common. We've got a lot of things in common, me and that guy. I don't like him, but I...
Actually, that's another thing you guys have in common. I don't think he likes him either.
No, I don't think he does. But yeah, we've got a lot of things in common. I mean, we've discussed before, you know, about the only thing that we don't have in common is, you know, I'll keep change that I get that I shouldn't have gotten and stuff like that. Well, he'll give it back.
And the goatee.
And the goatee. Just about everything else we agree on, pretty much.
So it's just the evil. That's the only real difference.
I play more video games than he does.
Yeah. But, more Pong.
Yeah. But that's it.
All right. Let's move on. Thanks, Kia, for your question. We got an anonymous one. Colgate claims people with diabetes are 2 times more likely to develop serious gum disease. Discuss.
What's Colgate?
Colgate.
Is that something over there that Is it like a research thing, or what is it?
Toothpaste company.
It is?
Yes.
How did you find that out?
Because I have a connection who gets me Colgate toothpaste over here. All the toothpaste in our universe tastes awful.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, that's toothpaste.
No. Toothpaste in their dimension is nice and minty.
You're just making that up.
No, I'm telling you.
No, come on. Toothpaste. Nope. Why do you make this stuff up? It's not... You don't know what Colgate is, really. You're just making it up.
Well, for the sake of the question, I don't suppose it matters. Although I would argue that we're a toothpaste company. No, there is no value in a toothpaste company making that claim. Yeah, so it doesn't really matter who makes the claim. Unless Colgate is a company that sells anti-diabetes meds and dental... I don't even know. Why would somebody say this is what I'm wondering.
But the reason you're making up that Colgate is a toothpaste company is because they ask about gum disease.
Yeah.
Maybe Colgate is a dentist college.
I feel like this is some poor statistical analysis. I feel like there could be a tremendous amount of lurking variables here.
You mean like the fact that a lot of people with diabetes eat a lot of sugar?
Or at least did. I think one could argue, in more simple terms, that the Venn diagram of behaviors one does that could cause gum disease and behaviors one does that could cause diabetes have a lot of overlap.
A lot of overlap. I suppose so.
But that there is no actual causal relationship between the two. This is a thing the producer and I both have this. We have very serious issues about statistics in this house. The phrase correlation is not causation and the phrase lurking variable both come up in our house frequently and non-ironically.
I do have a feeling though that the fact that Colgate is making this claim is important. Or else, why would the Anon say that Colgate says this? And why would Colgate be deceptive about it, sneaky about it? Like, hey, if you have diabetes, you should, I don't know, brush your teeth more? Is that what they're saying?
Well, I'm not claiming they're being deceptive. I'm claiming they're being stupid.
No, but what are they trying to accomplish? No, they're not being stupid. They're specifically trying to get people with diabetes to do something, probably.
Oh, so they come out with a product that fights gum disease specifically, and they write on the back, by the way, if you have diabetes, which a metric fuck ton of Americans have now, you really need to watch out for this shit. And then they sell lots of their newfangled thing.
That combats gum disease. Well, you know, maybe it is. Maybe you're being honest about the toothpaste thing.
I wouldn't bank on it. That doesn't sound like me, to be honest.
Well,
But then again,
coincidentally, you might be right.
That's like me saying this statement is a lie. Like, you know, how can you tell if I'm being honest now I'm not honest?
Okay. Whether or not you were lying, it was probably a good guess on your part that they make toothpaste. But the thing you were clearly lying about is that toothpaste tastes good over there. Because if toothpaste tasted good, why would they have to manipulate diabetics to brush their teeth with it? Aha, I got you there.
But if it's a toothpaste company, maybe this is a different product. Maybe this is special anti-gum disease mouthwash or special hooks that you stick in your mouth when you sleep.
Maybe a special brush, too.
Yeah, so...
Okay, fine.
So I might not be full of shit.
Well, it...
I want you to acknowledge the possibility. No. I admit that the likelihood is that I'm full of shit at all times. But I want you to acknowledge the possibility that in this instance, it is technically possible.
Here's what I acknowledge. I think you had a good guess on that they're a company that have something to do with oral hygiene. That was a good guess. But about the good-tasting toothpaste, I think that's crazy. And all the other stuff, you're just pulling out of your butt. So I'll grant you the oral hygiene company thing. That was okay. That was good. Well done. But the rest of it, you're just making it up.
Okay, I'm willing to buy that.
Okay. Are we ready for another one of these?
So we think this is inherently a manipulative.
Well, yeah, they're
concept.
Yes, I think this is probably an oral hygiene company, and they're probably trying to get diabetics to buy their product or to use the product that they already buy more often.
Which is hilarious. Because, in general, if you have type 2 diabetes, taking care of your body really has not been high on your priority list already.
Mm-hmm.
As a type 2 diabetic myself, I can say this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really, if you got your shit together about taking care of your health, you wouldn't have it in the first place. So now suddenly you're going to be like, oh my God, my gums! Really? Come on. If you're even paying attention at this point, you're more like, oh my God, my foot! Like, you're not, no.
Or your kidneys, or your retinas. Or...
Diabetes will kill your everything. It's ridiculous.
Heart. Yeah, yeah.
Anything in your body that uses blood, diabetes can fuck it up.
And not only that, but if your gum disease is related to the blood problems that you have with diabetes, there's probably not very much an oral hygiene company is going to do to help you combat that.
No, but that's interesting. You might have another variable here. Could that be a thing?
Well, it's possible, but
could the circulation issues contribute to gum disease?
I don't know, but even if it did, what could an oral hygiene...
No, they can't. They can't. But I'm curious about... I'm going back to actually the statement itself.
Oh, okay.
Could that be a thing?
I don't know.
Maybe diabetics really are two times because of that.
I don't know.
I guess that's not a lurking variable. That actually implies genuine causation.
I have no idea. I've never heard of that. I mean...
Well, I've never heard of this at all.
You know, as you know, my mother suffered from diabetes, and it was responsible for her untimely demise. And
yeah.
So, you know, there was...
How were her gums?
Well, I don't remember that. Okay. I mean, she lost a leg, and there were kidney concerns. And, of course, there's always the concern about blindness, even though that didn't come up. With her, and congenital heart failure and congenital heart whatever, but I don't remember anyone ever mentioning anything about, you know, her gums. But naturally, what all of that has in common is circulatory problems.
Yep,
it's all circulatory problems,
and that's the big thing with the diabetes.
But I don't know if having gum disease and circulation problems have any connection with one another.
I don't know.
But I don't remember her
having any.
We
have to hunt down this Colgate company.
Well, you know, like I said, we can check their internet. That's what they call it over there. And we can see stuff. Maybe they're on there. We can look them up.
All right. Well, thanks for your question, Anonymous.
If you find out that it's an oral hygiene company, tell me. Because I'd be really interested to know if you were right about that.
Maybe they're just a car company.
Stuart asks, do you believe we could slip into a dystopian future, and how do you envision that future?
Well, we're in another universe, so I'm trying to figure out if I should say we already are in a dystopian future, or we're never going to be.
Well, it's relative, isn't it? I mean, you know.
I don't feel especially dystopian.
No, we live here, but other people might think... Well, okay, for example, if what you were saying was true about toothpaste over there, they might think that we live in a dystopian future because we have horrible tasting toothpaste.
And it depends on who you ask even here. The people who live below the cloud cities on the surface, where all the pollution is and everything, might consider our world to be dystopian. We don't up here.
No.
But it's nice.
But the toothpaste tastes the same no matter where
it does. I've heard that's because it's made from the poor.
And they brush with it too?
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is extra gross. But
well, anyway. Toothpaste is a great equalizer. That's all I can say. Everybody brushes with the same stuff, and it's awful.
No, I think this is a fascinating question, even though at first it seems really banal.
That's not a very nice thing to say to Stuart.
Well, yeah, fuck Stuart. I don't even think he listens anymore. In fact, I called him out on it a while back. But I think he might be going to catch up. But anyway, no. Well, the thing is, the question immediately necessitates a joke about how we're already there, followed by some very serious hand-wringing about how, yes, we totally could, and we're very close to that point already.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And case closes over. I think it's way more interesting to look at the concept, because realistically, a dystopian future is by and large a literary concept.
Yes, right.
And also, existentially speaking, I think you could make the argument that you can't be in a dystopia. You can only observe a dystopia from a distance. Be that chronologically or metaphysically or geographically.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I mean, that kind of goes along with what I said about it being relative. But
exactly, yeah. At any given time, that's just life.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
the way we're living now might seem like a dystopia to people who lived 400 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
although we often look at people who lived 400 years ago and think that that's a little like a dystopia because, you know, there was, well, a lot of things. But
well, common features. Major class... I lost the word.
Stratification or...
Disparity. Disparity.
Oh, disparity.
Major class disparity. Major, I mean, this ties in, but major differences in lifestyle level.
Horrific things are happening that are treated normal by somebody.
Yes. A veneer,
usually the powerful people.
A veneer of tranquil order and consensus and democracy,
mm-hmm.
covering gross manipulation and corruption.
Mm, right, right, right.
Corporations manipulating things both overtly and covertly,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a largely ignorant and complacent mass.
Or disaffected and bitter class
and disenfranchised,
that doesn't
yeah.
feel like they can do anything about it.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they know what's going on, but what can they do? Nothing. So.
And really, I think what is described there can arguably be attributed to any society of a certain scale.
Yeah, I agree. Especially since... Well, since a very long time ago.
But I think, you know, if I was going to build a society from the ground up, I just don't think it's feasible to have it above a certain scale without running into this exact...
I completely agree. I completely agree.
Well, and I thought you would, because you're very much a small community-based anarchist.
Yes, that's right.
I
don't think it's sociologically, scientifically possible because, yes. as I've often pointed out, and the other William has pointed this out too, this is another thing we agree on, is that the only way you can have a functional society is if whenever you have a group of people, it has to run according to the principles of consensus. But as we all know, you can't operate a group according to consensus if it's too large, because it's not practical. You're never going to get everybody to agree.
Odds are somebody's going to.
That's right. So you might think to yourself, well, that's not a problem. We can just rule by democratic process. But that adds coercion to the equation, because 51% of the people are going to force 49% of the people, yes. to do things a certain way. And as soon as you introduce coercion into it, well, to me, that's already bad. But if that's not bad enough for you, well, right on the heels of coercion is corruption. So therefore, any organization that is so big that it can't be run by consensus is going to be corrupt, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't reform it. You can't change it. You can't introduce new laws to fix it. The only way you can deal with it is to break it into smaller groups and let that small group, that interacting, overlapping small group dynamic take over.
Now, let me ask you this.
Now, that's sociological fact. That's not just an ideological speculation or position.
Yeah,
that's just how it is.
Well, let me ask you this. If we start considering scarcity in the equation, or more specifically, a lack of it, if we could possibly achieve a post-scarcity economy and a post-scarcity society, can we avoid this? and still grow in scale?
Yes, absolutely. The best way for it to work...
Can we, though?
No. Even economists agree that the backbone of our economy, even today, is small businesses. Everybody agrees, who are experts in these areas, that the most vibrant and innovative and agile way of organizing is for you to have a whole bunch of small, overlapping, interdependent groups. It's much better than having everything centralized and having some big behemoth that can barely move. In fact, in those behemoths, the only time anything ever gets done is when someone on the bottom notices nothing's getting done, and that tiny group of people, they take matters in their own hands and they get something done. And then they either let the people on the top take credit for it, or they lie to the people on the top about how it was done. And that's how things go forward. It's not because someone on the top is actually brilliant and somehow told the people on the bottom exactly what they needed to do. Those people did it, and then something got done. It doesn't work that way.
Okay. I feel like what you just said completely was not addressing the question I
asked. Yeah, okay. I was in a roundabout way sort of getting to it. But the point I was trying to make there was that if all we had were those small interlocking groups, we could accomplish all the things that people usually ascribe to these large, like corporate or government structures that are really big. That those things don't really accomplish things people think they do. It's all always accomplished by small groups. So if you get rid of the facade or the farce that is these large groups, everything's still going to get done, and it's going to get done better, quicker, and more efficiently. But the thing is, the reason it's hard for people to imagine is because there was a time on our planet, much less in our country, where groups of the size that I'm talking about might be very, very isolated, and things might happen to them where some kind of crisis occurs or whatever, and they could really use the help of some adjacent group like I'm talking about, but there isn't a really close by adjacent group. And so people just naturally think that, well, to help in a situation like that where the groups are spread out and they're they're not very dense, is you need a larger group on top of that so that when this group gets in trouble, they can tell the bigger organization and they can go 100 miles away to this group that's doing better and they can help that other group or whatever. But, you know, population densities today just about everywhere are such that you don't really need that kind of organization, that high-level organization. And you probably didn't need it then either. There were ways to get around it, but that's all beside the point. Today, we don't really need all that. I mean, we could organize in a lot more efficient, agile, and innovative ways.
Okay. At this point, I'm thinking you actually didn't hear or didn't understand.
Oh, maybe that's true. I'm sorry.
Because I still feel like you didn't even remotely addressing my question.
Well, clarify it, and I'll either tell you how I thought I addressed it, or maybe I didn't understand.
Well, there's a couple levels to it, but the simple one to start off is, in what we would term a post-scarcity situation where tomorrow somebody discovers essentially unlimited energy and consequently the ability to make unlimited supplies of all needed resources.
Okay, well, okay, now keep in mind, though, my understanding is that we've never... The only reason we live in a scarcity situation now is because somebody benefited from that and we're convinced that we have to have it. We could have avoided that altogether to begin with. We don't have to wait for some miraculous technological invention to have that. We just have to have people realize the people who are telling them that we have to rely on scarcity are full of it, and they're lying, and we don't have to believe that.
Okay. But let's say we had some miraculous technological invention.
Fine, okay,
tomorrow.
Sure.
Everybody knows this, and we're all good.
Okay, sure.
At that point, could you expand society, an individual society? Does the rule no longer apply then? In a post-scarcity situation, can you essentially grow the scale of your society as large as you want and avoid
I see what you're saying.
Said dystopian issues?
No. Because that's not what it's about. It's about... It's just about the sociological reality of... There's only so many people you can have in a group and still have consensus. And I mean, if... if what you're getting at is that it's about a scarcity of resources that causes people to have these disagreements and stuff in the first place, well, then there's all kinds of reasons people have difficulty organizing and forming groups. And people just function best in these smaller groups.
Well, and I think the argument could be made that in this hypothetical situation, when we are now post-scarcity and all resources are achievable by everyone constantly, we would inherently gravitate towards these smaller groups. Because, basically, tomorrow, or we'll say a year from now to get it moving, everybody has, there's no more need. Everybody's got whatever they want. Everybody. The next time we as a large group try and make any sort of consensus or even democratic decision, the people who disagree have no reason to stick around
with
the group.
That's right. That's exactly
right.
They'll
go stick around with the people who agree with them.
Yes, yes, yes.
And so very quickly you whittle that down to a small group of people who pretty much agree with you all the time.
But what's interesting about that, though, is that a lot of stories that are kind of the opposite of dystopian, not so much utopian, though, but that suggests that maybe our culture technology will make everything great. They always envision that when that happens, we're going to become a global culture or something. We're going to be united in peace. But I think it's closer to what you're saying is that if it happened that somehow everybody could get what they needed without anybody's help, as human beings, they would still form little groups, but they wouldn't any longer feel like they need to be associated with a much, much larger group. And so,
well, arguably everybody would see kind a of microcosmic version of this on the internet.
Well, sure, sure.
That's what happens.
That's right.
We're
that's
forming
right.
communities based on agreeing with each other.
Right. And there's no one, I mean, nobody would think of the internet as anything like one place.
No.
Or whatever.
And in the information age here, we're also getting much more polarized. People are not having political and social dialogue, they're watching the one channel that totally agrees with them.
Well, right, but see that...
ignoring the others.
But back in the day when I was first writing about computer-mediated interaction and what its potentials were, it really has the potential to do both things. Obviously, it can provide a person with many different viewpoints so that they are an open-minded person and whatever, but it can also be a place where you can find tons of sources that just tell you what you already think and what you already know. So it can be used for both things. It can be something where there's a lot of information out there that prevents you from being prejudiced and being single-minded. Or, conversely, you can find all kinds of places that are going to tell you you're right, and you can just stick with those places.
Well, and I feel like socially that's more what's occurring.
But that is, and the reason that that's what's occurred is because because we already had a bias toward that kind of perspective and that kind of narcissistic use of the medium because of how we use television and how television was presented to us by the princes of our society, the corporate world and advertisement and everything else. We'd already been given a information technology. Again, television could have been used to educate, enlighten, and open people's minds, or it could have been used to make people more narcissistic and focused on themselves and what shoes they should be wearing, what car they should be driving. And of course, because television was controlled by corporations, or in the sociological parlance, the palace, it encouraged the use of that technology toward narcissism. So when the internet came along, and again, it could be used for this or the other thing, we were already in that narcissistic frame of mind. So that's the way that's the way its use got pushed, and that's where it is now. But the thing is, mobile technologies are kind of pushing things the other way. Because even though mobile technologies are given to us by the princes of our society, people think of them as theirs, right? They belong to the masses, I guess. And a lot of them are equipped with cameras, usually very good cameras. And you can get... not just still photograph cameras, but movie cameras, and you can get good sound, which means that conceivably, even already in our culture now, conceivably, if you're a CEO or a politician or whatever, and you're giving a speech or you're in the boardroom, it's not inconceivable that somebody who's there is recording what you're doing without you realizing it. So, in other words, lots of common people have basically what 30 years ago would be considered high-tech spy equipment. Thus, these And as CEOs and politicians and whoever the powerful people become more cognizant of this, it's going to affect how they do things and when they do them and where they do them. And the idea is that over time, they're just going to say, you know what, we have to clean up our act here because there's no way we can prevent someone from blowing the whistle on us with these tiny little devices that they're carrying around.
Yeah, I feel like a layer has already been created on that. And unfortunately, what's happened instead is that the masses are lowering the bar.
Well, but
they're saying, well, this guy, we've caught him doing this, but at least he's not as bad as these guys.
No.
So he still gets my vote as the lesser evil.
Right. But what I'm talking about, and that's true, that's exactly what's happening. But there's this potential, and you see it more with other countries that, you know, have dictatorships or oppressive regimes where they're having these protests and they're taking pictures and video and putting it on the internet and stuff. You see it more happening there. Or the potential of it happening.
Well, and a change like this potentially has to be generational.
Yes,
because basically what you need is people coming up who have cleaned up their act.
Right. But
we're too early for that.
That's right. And also it's too early to tell where it's going to go. You can see where it could go, and you know why it could go that way, because you've got the technology, plus you've got it in the hands of what sociology would call the market, or the masses, rather than the princes or the temples. But it could still go the other way because we television and early internet have still, and like those little MP3 players and stuff, all these things encourage people to be narcissistic. And that is a huge part of our culture right now. And there's a good chance that we'll never get over that. There's a good chance that where the technology is going to go is toward greater and greater narcissism and
isolation.
And isolation.
Not unlike the story you wrote.
That's right. So, I mean, who knows? But you could see the possibility is what I'm getting at. And I guess, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic about that. But as far as a dystopian future, I mean, if things were to get more dystopian than they are now, I think it would be along the lines of an even greater situation where a small group of people is ruling the larger group, but the larger group doesn't really care as long as they're getting their apps or they're getting whatever the technology demand is, as long as they're getting that, they don't care.
Yeah.
But how dystopian is that if nobody cares? I mean, what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If 90% of the people are okay with it, is it really a dystopian?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, it is to me and it is to you, but
inherently you're talking about the entire premise of Brave New World right there.
Well, and a lot of
stuff. You don't know you are being forced into a role until you try and step outside of that.
Well, except that I think it's more like The Matrix, where you know how in that story there was this notion that that the reason the Matrix that they eventually went with, the reason it worked was because people were unconsciously choosing it.
Yeah.
I think it's more like that, where it's not that people don't know; it's that they do know, but they're okay with it because it works for them, and they can maybe imagine things getting better, but they don't want to put in the effort to make it better, and nobody else is going to do it. So yeah, we can live with this.
No, but that's why I very much think Brave New World, because in Brave New World, no one is saying that anyone is suffering, or that it's at all bad, or that living outside of that society is better. In fact, it is very much not, and we see this. The argument, I think there's two fundamental arguments in Brave New World. One being that the society that has been created has essentially dehumanized its populace. They may be happy, but they're no longer people. But also that you are not completely free. And you aren't aware of this until you try and do something outside. Nobody wants to step outside the society. But if somebody tries it, you find that you're not allowed to.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I mean, even today, if you were to stop a person and ask them, would you rather be happy or human? I mean, that's a valid question that I wouldn't be surprised to hear a lot of people say, well, it might depend a little bit on what you mean by being inhuman. But if you just mean I'm still like a person, but I'm not
Yes.
A little bit of my humanity is gone, but I feel happy all the time. Yeah.
I'd rather be that, right.
Because that's what they do anyway, by drinking or drugs or whatever addiction they use to keep themselves, you know, peppy or whatever.
But if you asked people, someone on the street, would you rather be happy or free? While I think a large number of them would rather be happy, I think a much larger number would think that they'd rather be free.
Well, yeah, I suppose.
I think that most people you ask that question to would say, I'd rather be free, even though their actual lifestyle, like, belays that.
Well, you might be right, but I think we're...
I am one of the few people I know who is pretty open about the fact that if I am happy and comfortable, I don't really give a fuck.
Well, I think a lot of people... I think you'd be surprised just how many people feel that way. I mean, for one thing, I think if you were to ask most Europeans that question... I mean, I think it would be a very natural thing for them to say...
Well, life is fleeting,
no,
I felt so bad. I heard somebody on a podcast the other day use the word ennui, and they clearly had never heard it and just read it, because I believe they said...
Well, how could they even pronounce it, if that's the case?
I believe they didn't. That's the problem. I believe they said... Anuai or something.
They pronounced it wrong.
And it took me a long time to figure out what the word was, because it was just such a grossly different pronunciation, like anuai or something like that. And I was like, what? It's like, did he mean ennui? In the context, it kind of sounds like he meant ennui.
Oh, okay. The context was right.
Yeah, no, I used the word in the right place. Just really could not say the word.
Well, I don't know anyone who could say it if they never heard it. And they weren't French.
Yeah.
Or didn't know. French.
No, I mean, well, I ran into this all the time growing up, reading books and playing role-playing games. This came up all the time for
us. Oh, sure. Yeah,
how are you?
Scimitar.
Discipline. Envelope as a verb.
Envelope as a verb.
He was good. Enveloped in a field of light. That one came up for many years. Yeah, so if you're just joining us, welcome to my dinner with Andre.
Well, the answer to your question, Stuart, is of course we can slip into a dystopian future. I mean, that's always possible. More dystopian than it is now, I mean. But, and I suppose I just said what I would envision it to be.
Say it's right now, because that would be a dystopian present.
That's right.
So, it's a future. It has to be. Something you said brought to mind a thing that has been bouncing around Facebook lately. Which seems really trite, but it just boils down to such a wonderful piece of belief that I think I hold too, and it's the concept children should be taught how to think, not what to think.
Yes, right. That's right.
And at first it seems very, very trite to me, but it's a pretty fundamental, boiled down, simple concept that I think I have very strong belief in.
Well, I mean, you know, I've had an...
I think maybe I'm just sneer at it because it's on Facebook. And
well,
I've
had an opportunity to, you know, have a lot of influence in the upbringing of three kids. And, of course, that was my philosophy was I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm going to try to tell you how to think. Whatever the kids asked me a question about... A political question or a question, philosophical question. If it was not a factual question, well, one thing we play this game with the kids called Fact or Opinion, where we'd make a statement and they had to decide, tell us if we were, you know, saying a fact or opinion, and we explained to them how important it was to be able to differentiate those things because if it's a fact, it's just a fact. I mean, every sane person is going to know this is true, scientific fact or whatever. But if it's an opinion, you can have your own feelings about it, and you know, you still have to know how to reason out your opinion so it doesn't sound ridiculous, but you can have an opinion and someone else can have a different opinion, and that's okay. So when they would ask me a question where the answer would be an opinion, I would share with them the various viewpoints on it, and invariably they'd ask me what my personal opinion was, and I'd make it clear that this is my personal opinion, and I'd let them know that they need to work out what their opinion is based on what they value. Do they think this is important? And if they do, then they probably have this opinion. Do you think this is important? Then you should have that opinion. And I tried to help them understand that you don't just ask people what something is and when they tell you, just believe it.
Yeah.
Think about it and consider what you what you want your life to be about, what you want to accomplish in your life, and think through it critically. And I think we did a reasonably good job of teaching the kids how to think. I can't say that I'm perfectly happy with how all that turned out, but in terms of them knowing how to think critically, yeah, I'm pretty satisfied we accomplished that, especially when they're teenagers and you're trying to get them to take a certain course of action, and they immediately start breaking into how their opinion how things should go is
which
this.
Which always becomes a thing. But and it's funny because ethically, I very much buy into the concept, but the more I think about it, practically, it's very important because the opposite only works in a completely static situation.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
If you teach people what to think, that only holds insofar as the situation stays the same. Mm-hmm. And you cannot adapt if you don't know how to think. It's funny. I don't know if you have this. Do you remember, and for me it was a very big milestone as a kid, the day you realized one of your political beliefs was different than your parents?
No, because my parents never talked about politics. I didn't even know what my parents' political beliefs were until...
Because for me, because in school, we always voted. You know, whenever there was a presidential election, like, we had a little classroom election and all that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. And frequently, they would really do the whole thing. Like, we'd vote on many ballot measures and stuff and see what the class thought. And I always voted like my parents.
Oh.
And I always believed...
I didn't even know what my parents voted.
Oh, so no, my parents... I just voted whatever. The producer's family is more like that, too. They won't talk about it so much. My parents were always very open about that kind of stuff, and I always agreed with them. Because they were my parents. At the time, I thought it always made sense. And the funny thing is, to this day, I don't remember what it was, but I remember the sort of shock and discomfort with the fact that I'm, like, my parents had it, and I'm like, I understand that entirely. I would vote the other way. And that was really... I had this very much, like... stepping out on very unsure ground. And I believed it, and my parents, supported it. But it was such a weird step, because it's easy to say that I know how to think independently before it's ever challenged.
Yeah, that's true.
Once it comes up, I'm like, and I still respected my parents and considered them fairly intelligent people, so I'm like, so what does this mean that I'm thinking differently? And it was very weird and very profound on me at the time.
Well, I think it's always profound when the first moment where you're very cognizantly having to, hold an opinion that is different than someone else's opinion, and yet you're maintaining, like you said, respect. You know, there's a temptation.
It's not ending my relationship with that
right,
person.
Right. It's so that it's kind of hard for the unsophisticated mind to go, wait a minute, how does this work? How can I have the exact same relationship I had with them before, or maybe even a better one, while now I have this fundamental disagreement with them?
And that was another mind-blowing one, was the day my parents voted differently on an issue.
From each other?
Yes.
Oh.
There was a law in Oregon, a ballot measure thing that came up about legalizing physician-assisted suicide.
Oh.
And my parents both had very strong opinions in opposite directions. And that was absolutely mind-blowing to me.
Wow.
I don't remember how it ended up playing out, actually. And I completely, especially now that I'm older and things, I completely understand why they both came from what perspectives they did and why they had different opinions. But it was very weird to me, and the fact that, like, this didn't, like, they stayed married, and they stayed happily married.
Well, my folks often wouldn't go to vote, and I'd say, how come you guys aren't voting? And they always said, well, because I'm going to vote one way, and your mom's going to vote the other way, and there's no point in going.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know which was which, actually. I think I can guess that my dad was voting Republican and my mom was voting Democrat. But sometimes they wouldn't go because they knew that one person was going to, as they thought, nullify the other person's vote, And so they wouldn't even go.
Of course, they're missing a whole axis on this kind of
stuff. No, that's true. But that's what they thought.
But that's a fascinating idea.
They thought. And they didn't argue about it or fight. I mean, my folks fought about a lot of things, but they never fought about that.
Yeah, well, by and large, my folks agree. When it came to voting, I think 99-point-something% of the time they voted exactly the same.
Well, I can remember the first, you know, disagreement about some big thing that I had with my parents. It was probably a religious thing. Although before that, it was probably a child-rearing thing. Like, maybe they did something with one of my siblings or with us, and I thought, that wasn't a very good move.
And I had those...
I think that probably happened first.
Years later, I mean, I had when I was 12, I think, and my father at a family gathering spanked me. And he had not done that in
years. Wow, when you
were
12.
Yeah,
man.
And that's the thing. He spanked me when I was younger. He hadn't spanked me in years. Mm-hmm. He spanked me there. And my mom and I were both absolutely mortified.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that became a thing. And he apologized and he explained how he had been spanked till he was 14. And, you know, and it was about...
That's interesting.
Well, my dad had all sorts of fascinating upbringing issues. But so, I mean, I had those, and they were made, but I just remember the first time that that was a conscious thing of, like, I feel, I am self-aware of having this sort of mature opinion on something, on a real issue, not, you know, white bread or wheat bread, a real issue, and my parents, for whom have been my guiding light in all of these things, have a differing one.
Yeah.
It was very, very weird to me. And kind of cool. I mean, scary, but very much a rite of passage.
Yeah.
I had similar things like when I felt old enough to argue with my grandparents. I felt that was a very important, like, rite of passage in my life.
Mm.
Little did I know would come the even more important stage of when I got old enough to not argue with my grandparents any longer.
Yeah. Right.
Which was a very great one, too. But, we've hit time, so we should probably...
Well, thank you, Kia B, Stuart, and Anon.
Yes, and who knows when we will see you again, people.
But we don't know. It all depends on the boneheads. And
whenever those assholes get lazy.
Yeah, or whatever they do.
Or die. Then...
Oh, wait a minute. What? What if they die? Are we going to have to keep doing
this?
We'll
have to do this every week. Yeah. Oh, it's in the contract.
Contract?
$10.
Yeah. You told me that the $10 thing stopped after the first four.
Yes, I did.
All right. When this is done, you are going to give me my $50.
What if I just give you some good taste in toothpaste?
You don't have any of that.
That's true.
Please disregard the previous hour of useless audio. This has been a production of the Magical Talking Ant Podcast. If you would like to contact us, and I don't know why you would, please do so at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. All music is provided courtesy of Jay Underberg. More of his PodSafe audio can be found at podsafeaudio.com/Jay_Underberg. Thank you.